Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's Friday night, and we're celebrating the 150th birthday of Giuseppe Verdi's dark, complicated, and immensely popular opera, Il Trovatore. Several years after its premiere, the 19th-century Boston publication Dwight's Journal of Music said of Il Trovatore, it is almost the only opera. It stands for all operas. Since its first performance at the Teatro Apollo in Rome, January 19, 1853, Il Trovatore, or The Troubadour, took the world by storm and for years remained one of the most performed and most loved operas. In the 20th century, the great opera fell out of style, with its credulity-stretching plot of gypsies, obsessive love, and accidental incineration. Add to that an incredibly difficult vocal score, and Il Trovatore simply faded from the pantheon. Our guest tonight, writer and author William Berger, says it's time to look and listen again. The crazed emotionality and furious flux of Il Trovatore speaks to our moment in history, the anvil chorus and the dogs of war, old hatreds and sudden death, and a primal emotional thrust, he says, that presages rock and roll. Tonight we'll listen to highlights of Il Trovatore to rediscover Verdi's great work in its time and in our own. Our guest tonight from New York City is William Berger, a writer, lecturer, and author of many books on opera, including Verdi with a Vengeance, an energetic guide to the life and complete works of the King of Opera. Good evening and welcome, William Berger.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
It's wonderful to have you. So you write and say that here we have an opera that sits somewhere deep in the tangled roots of rock and roll. Why? What?
Well, that's going to take me a moment to explain that, but what I'm saying is partially just being crazy, but secondly, I'm talking about emotion in the human voice, and I'm talking about instruments as a percussive, rhythmic, driving force. In 1853, that sounded absolutely barbaric. Today, it is the world we live in.
This opera came in the middle of the career of one of the great Italian opera composers of all time.
One of the great artists of all time.
Giuseppe Verdi. He was in the midst of writing Rigoletto and La Traviata at the same time. Give us a taste of the story that is so famously complicated, so famously bizarre, and yet endlessly compelling in El Trovatore.
The first thing to remember is that people don't believe this these days, but Il Trovatore was based on a very successful play. So even without all the terrific music, there was something in this story that did capture people's imaginations right away, even though it was completely insane. And that, in fact, is the world we're looking at in Il Trovatore. What is life like at the edge, at the complete edge? You know, people sometimes will say, this story is crazy, this opera is crazy. Well, it's not like Verdi didn't know that, and that's what attracted him to it. What we basically have going on in a real bare-bones outline, mm-hmm. which just makes it sound funnier, so go ahead and laugh. That's okay. We'll play some music.
We won't laugh. We're ready to go out there on the edge of this, with this
story.
That's
right. Well, we have a gypsy woman who's almost insane, but the scary thing is that she isn't completely insane. Mm-hmm. And something very terrible happened in the past. Her mother was burned at the stake by this evil count, and in order to take revenge on him, she throws the count's newborn baby into the fire. But being completely emotionally wrought at this point, she sort of makes a really big boo-boo and accidentally throws her own baby onto the fire. So the rest of her life is kind of dictated by this dealing with this situation she's gotten herself into.
It's not the son of the count that burns in the ashes of her mother, but her own son.
Yes. Now, nobody knows that, and that sort of comes out in the course of the opera. see, one thing that's rather funny is when she's telling people what she did, saying that she burned the son of the count in the fire, even the people on the stage don't believe her and say, oh, that's too weird, let alone when they find out at the very end. I'm giving away the ending here. I know a lot of people get upset by that.
Go right
ahead. We find out that it was her own son she threw into the fire, and then she raised the count's son as her own. And there's a very intense mother-son relationship through this opera that's pretty heavy stuff. And the two rivals, the tenor and the baritone, of course, are always trying to kill each other. And at the very end, one of them succeeds. And when he finds out that it was his brother all along, it's just, it's terrific stuff.
But her supposed son, in fact, it emerges, the son of the count, Manrico, is the tenor.
That's right.
He's up against the count himself?
He's up against the new count, the
yes.
young count, the Count di Luna. So right away, you know, it's the names are a giveaway, right? This guy's a little loony too, right? No, that's not accidental. These people knew what they were writing.
Mm-hmm.
So we have them going at each other, and wouldn't you know it, of course they're both what they politely used to call in love with the same woman.
Leonora.
Yes, Leonora, which is just the definitive opera name. And the Count is looking to abduct and rape her, but they still call that love at certain times in history. And they're both fighting over her. So we've got a real mess here going between these four people.
A terrible thirst for vengeance, a mistake in the execution of vengeance the first time around, and just calamity piled upon calamity, this brooding desire for revenge throughout. I want to get right to a piece of this, just to give us a sense of how far out there Verdi got with this opera, that people will know from all kinds of later uses and often from mocking uses. It's the famous anvil chorus of the gypsies at dawn, Act 2, Scene 1. Can you set this up for it? What's going on here, William Berger? And then tell us about where else we may have heard this music in one form or another.
We've already had a lot of complications in Act 1. We've heard half of the story. The Count and the troubadour, the tenor, have already had a little fight over the soprano. And now we move to Act 2, a camp of gypsies in the mountains. And they're just waking up and going about their gypsy business, which in this case is blacksmithing. But meanwhile, I want people to imagine in the corner an old woman staring into the fire and unable to tear herself away through the whole thing. And let's listen to it, and then let's talk about a couple of the tunes this might bring up.
Here we go, and the Anvil Chorus from Il Trovatore. There it is, just in that moment, that kind of wild, everything playing in the crazy tick-tock behind it. Talk about crying out for mockery later, and that happened. This passage has come many ways into pop culture. Tell us about that.
Well, one of the reasons that it's such good grist for the parodists is because if you've heard it once, it will never get out of your head for the rest of your life, right? It's a completely familiar melody. Even if some of the listeners just heard it for the first time right now, which I find hard to believe, but it might be possible, you'll never forget it. So right away, you know, you can have fun with it. First of all, in and of itself, it really encapsulates this world of Il Trovatore, that offbeat that's going on. In this case, to make sure you don't miss the point, we've got an anvil, right? Dun, 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 right? This is the world
banging
offbeat.
Away.
Mm-hmm. Right? Out of whack. And that's something that, in perhaps more subtle ways, continues throughout the score. Sir Arthur Sullivan parodied it pretty effectively in The Pirates of Penzance, and it's very amusing when he has a bunch of pirates who are going to commit a robbery.
And the burglars' chorus.
The burglars' chorus, and they're saying, let's be very quiet so nobody can hear us. And they, of course, keep stomping their feet on the offbeat. And that tune would be, forgive my really bad singing, but, you know, rather than
you're the writer, not the singer, but we can hear it, and it comes right on down then to what became popular music. Hail, hail, the gang's all here, with the anvil in history's backdrop there.
Yes, and, you know, that was a tour that the Gilbert and Sullivan Players made in New York in 1929 that got picked up and was eventually in a Bowery Boys movie under those words, which I don't particularly understand, but I know my grandfather thought it was hilarious.
And that wasn't the end of it? The Marx Brothers got in on this? Babe the Pig got in on it?
Oh, yeah. Well, if that gets back to this idea of what does Trovatore stand for? Italian opera in general, in all of its excess and all of its emotionalism, and all of its intensity, both positive and negative. When the Marx Brothers chose to kind of have a little romp in the opera house in their movie A Night at the Opera in 1935, you just don't score any extra credit points for guessing that the opera on stage is Il Trovatore. It would have to be. It couldn't be anything else. And I think there's something about Il Trovatore that is a little dangerous, a little subversive. It sets you off on edge a little. And in fact, in that movie, it is sort of the gateway to this wonderful anarchy that the Marx Brothers revel in. And they destroy the whole place, and it's a terrific time.
They would recognize the over-the-top quality of it, and it keeps on coming through, even in that those pop culture references. But not everything here is over-the-top in quite that way. I want to get into some of the challenging vocals here. You've written that so much of Il Trovatore rests on the shoulders of singers, not least in the big contralto parts. Let's listen to a little bit of Stride le Vampa. Just after that crazed anvil chorus, the gypsy staring into the fire, remembering all that's gone wrong with this kind of otherworldly tone in the contralto.
Yeah, it really is a marvelous piece, and you can analyze it musically. She keeps being drawn back into a certain key she's trying to break out of. It's the past is literally bringing her back in tractor beams. And it's a wonderful musical portrayal of a psychological state, and one that, unfortunately, we can all relate to a certain extent, perhaps not to the extent of this poor distracted woman. But the other thing you notice even there, it's what we would call a waltz. It's written in 3/4 time, like oom-pa-pa, oom-pa-pa, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is a very hackneyed form of music. The guy with the monkey, the organ grinder, will probably
knows
play
it well.
Something like that. But there we need to sort of try and hear it fresh. I mean, in 1853 in Italy, it wasn't quite so hackneyed. So if we separate that out from every lousy waltz we've ever heard, because that's not the point here. You wouldn't dance to Stride la Vampa at your wedding unless you're really twisted. It has a forward motion to it, right? It's 3/4. There's something missing, and there's a missing beat there. So it's like a wheel. It keeps going forward. And that's also part of this driving force that's going on through Il Trovatore throughout the score.
Throughout the entire score. We're going to come back and talk more about the entire atmosphere of this opera, so popular in its day, so unpopular by the late 20th century, and now maybe a soundtrack that makes sense. We're talking tonight with William Berger. He's joining us from New York City, author of Verdi with a Vengeance. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are listening to and talking about tonight Giuseppe Verdi's Il Trovatore in the month of its 150th anniversary. Baleine, with a baritone, cuts loose in Il Trovatore. I'm joined tonight by William Berger. He's author of Verdi with a Vengeance, a writer, lecturer, and author of many books on opera. William Berger, you write about the demands on all the singers in this opera, not least the baritone, how much of this particular opera they have to carry on their shoulders as opposed to the orchestra. By design, no doubt?
No doubt. Verdi meant everything he did after a certain point in his career. He knew what he was doing. He also knew the human voice and what it could do better than anyone who's ever lived. And, you know, that's just flat out the way it is. So when he wrote Trovatore, he was looking to explore everything that can be explored, and primarily through the human voice and with the orchestra kind of helping out and driving it forward. I was just listening to Il Baleine right there along with everybody and thinking, wow, they just don't write them like that anymore.
Gorgeous, but very, very dark.
Very dark, very difficult to sing, deceptively simple sounding. You can whistle it and, you know, try singing it in the shower and you will hurt yourself, or at least singing it well. So that's another kind of disconnect that's going on. Sometimes the tunes sound easy. That doesn't mean they're easy to sing. But, especially in the case of Il Baleine, where it is difficult, again, I think Verdi knew what he was doing. He meant to do that. That gets a certain tension and, well, a certain tension in the voice that communicates emotional states really well.
And in this case, communicating almost a kind of menace. This is the evil count, I guess, singing about Leonora, the woman he's so drawn to, how he's going to have her. Let's listen to a bit more. And there you can hear it, that gorgeous sound, yet very dark, menacing, almost not that he's going to live happily ever after with this woman, but that he's going to rape her.
It brings up another really interesting point about something that stands between the art of Verdi's time and a lot of popular art we have now. You're bringing up this point, like, how could such beautiful music be about such a bad thing? And that's something we see a lot in the world of opera. You know, the good guys don't always wear white. People's emotions are sometimes, and actions are sometimes, a little less clearly delineated than we tend to like them in our movies.
And in that way, very true to life.
I think so. I think much more true to life than if he came on stage and made himself ugly because he is ugly and therefore made ugly sounds.
Mm-hmm. William Berger, put this opera, Il Trovatore, in the context of Verdi's enormous, complete body of work. What distinguishes it from his earlier work, his later work? It sits almost smack dab in the middle.
Right.
What sets it apart?
Well, after a certain point, maybe a couple of years before Il Trovatore, Verdi continued to write for another 50 years or so. But everything he wrote has a different tone, a different feel. Each opera is very different. And I think it's another reason to celebrate Verdi as a tremendous artist. some artists you feel were always trying to get the single idea right for their whole lives. Mm-hmm. And Verdi just went into different places with his works, with each one. And Trovatore being a good sort of pole of the whole work, this is, as we said before, this is life on the edge. This is what life looks like when viewed from the guts, so to speak. And so it holds its own. But at the same time, he wrote and produced La Traviata, which is a completely different work, also immensely popular, very easy to love, a very modern piece, whereas Trovatore is erroneously, I think, considered old-fashioned.
But you say it is, in fact, exceedingly modern. What are you pointing to when you see that?
I'm pointing to the fact that Trovatore has always been popular with audiences, mm-hmm. and always will be. I'm convinced of that. But, you know, you've got this thing in the opera world, this really scary thing called experts. You know what I mean?
Yes, we've heard of
who
them.
Who tell us what we're supposed to like and what we're not supposed to like. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure why this is so endemic in the opera world, even more than popular music or so on. But it is. And for a long time, we've been told that we're not supposed to like Il Trovatore.
That we not to admire it as we might other operas.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, a while ago, 100 years ago, 130 years ago, there were goals and ideals for opera that were kind of the antithesis of what's going on in Il Trovatore. Now, just, you know, a little bit of structure here. Let's talk about structure. I think that's one place where it annoyed a lot of the experts.
Because?
Because in Il Trovatore, you do have an old-fashioned structure. That is, say, for example, the tenor will walk out onto the stage alone, strike a glamour pose, mm-hmm. probably, mm-hmm. will sing a very pretty aria about something nice. A messenger will come and give him some news, and then he'll launch into a very loud aria about something not nice, and the curtain comes down amidst tons of applause on a good night.
So, and this now is that, a hackneyed form in the eyes
well,
of the expert.
Well, is it hackneyed? I mean, it was hackneyed in the 1870s. People were saying, let's try something new, and mm-hmm. I think they were quite right. You had mm-hmm. Wagner doing a completely different structure, and other people who decided that was the way to go. Mm-hmm. And a lot of great stuff came out of that, too. You know, I really admire Wagner's art, too, so we're not comparing. They used to say you had to either be a Wagner fan or a Verdi fan. And those of us who are opera people have always thought that's ridiculous.
It sounds to me like they simply have different points of reference, with the Verdi pointing back to an older kind of classical form of drama, theater, opera, Wagner pointing ahead.
No. That's what they wanted us to believe.
All right.
I think they were both pointing ahead. And eventually they both came to the same place. Verdi basically agreed with people that he wanted to transcend the old forms of, you know, an aria, duet, this sort of thing, yeah. and write things all the way through. And he eventually did do that in his later works. But so in a way, he ended up in the same place as Wagner. So when he was doing his later works in the 1880s and this sort of thing, mm-hmm. Il Trovatore structurally seemed old-fashioned. However, paradoxically, I don't think it does anymore, and I'll tell you why. We've learned a lot in the theater about some moments in time take longer than other moments mm-hmm. in time, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We've had Einstein. We've had relativity.
The density of experience.
For example, we've had Pirandello. And a lot of things that the idea of somebody, say, having an internal moment mm-hmm. and expressing it externally doesn't seem unnatural to us anymore.
Not at all. There can be an eternity in that internal moment. You write about how at so many points in this opera, it is wild, it is uninhibited, it's this got this relentless intensity. I want to hear just a bit of that in the crowning tenor solo of the piece. Tell us about this solo.
Well, a perfect example, because critics in the late 19th century complained that what happened is here's a tenor who's saying, I've got to run right away. And what I think Verdi's exploring is how that feeling feels, and it takes 3 minutes for him to do that. What we've got going on here dramatically is, again, everyone's going to laugh, but that's all right, because after he sings it, we'll see who's laughing. You know, by the way, your mother's on fire. And he says, I've got to run and rescue her. And then we have another funny sort of rhythm in 5/4 time. You'll hear that beat, and he sings his heart out about that he's got to go and rescue her.
It sounds like a good idea. Let's listen. I'm struck at how, for people who are not necessarily opera aficionados, the idea of someone needing to run to take his mother out of the fire doesn't sound odd. It just sounds like a piece of opera drama.
Look at what we watch on TV. You know, I've had people say, oh, opera's unrealistic, it's outrageous, and by the way, did you see X-Files last night?
And who expects realism from opera? Anyway, what we expect is that kind of absolute stretch to communicate an emotion, and my goodness, we can hear it here.
In some more than others, and nowhere more than in Il Trovatore. There are other artists who did explore realism successfully, but here we're talking about what's really real is how it feels, and the urgency of Di Quella Pira is something everybody has felt at one time in their lives or another, whether or not their mothers have ever been on fire.
What does a tenor feel approaching that bit of singing?
Terror. Absolute terror. You can see them praying on stage. I have seen them throw up backstage right after Di Quella Pira, and that's when you know it's a good performance.
Verdi was expected to deliver in 1853? Is that what the audience came for, that absolute pushing of the boundaries, or were they put off by it?
Both. I mean, Verdi was considered a radical, and quite rightly, and was considered barbaric, vulgar, and tasteless, all of which in a certain sense is true. And like all new music that is considered barbaric and tasteless, it also drove people crazy in a positive way. I think it still does. I think, you know, people don't realize it, but you have if you have a good performance of Il Trovatore, you're going to have your feelings stirred in a way that you probably didn't expect within a theater. Mm.
The soprano has her work cut out for her in Il Trovatore, as well as the story reaches a climax. One of her pursuers, Manrico, is being held by the Count. She offers herself for his freedom and sings the Miserere. There, the big voice of a big character in Il Trovatore, taking the situation in hand, offering herself to try and win the release, the life of her lover, Manrico. A very bold sound, and in a way, kind of a gender-bending sound, William Berger.
Notice, she's the hero, and he's the damsel in distress up in the tower. And he's off stage in that scene, and she's singing all over the place, but primarily the guts of that passage are on the very lowest registers of her voice. He's singing on the very highest registers of his voice. The situation has given them different social roles, and then we hear the monks, they're off stage as well, intoning the prayers for his impending death, his execution, and they sound like the wall that stands between them. It's really an extraordinary, what would you call it, like diagram of individuals trapped in a societal situation and how that changes fundamentally who they are. It's also, you know, a hell of a tune.
It's a hell of a tune. And the monks chanting in the background, Verdi was no fan of the clergy.
No. Verdi was intensely anti-clerical, but I don't think that's particularly playing here. I think they're sort of trapped in doing something too. They're not actually killing Manrico. They're just sort of doing their job, which is saying their prayers. There's another instance in Verdi where it seems like the monks actually do the execution, and that would be a more of an exploration of that. But Verdi never, ever really liked to think of people as part of a group. He liked to look at the individuals within the group. I think this is the most radical thing in Verdi. He always gave the individual his or her due as a human being, which is why he worked with the voice so well. You can hear a single person, especially a soprano, cutting through an entire chorus, and it establishes the problem of the individual claiming his or her own personhood within the society. In Aida, you have her single voice coming through over a chorus of at least 120.
It sounds like
such a beautiful moment where he's saying, where you can tell to him what counts is not politics. His political point of view is what's happening to people. And that's going on in the Miserere also.
And a perfectly modern dilemma and focus, that individual trying.
More than modern. I think it is dangerous to many people. I think it's radical. I think it's beautiful.
We'll be back in a moment with more of Il Trovatore, Giuseppe Verdi's great opera. I'm joined tonight by William Berger. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Giuseppe Verdi's great opera, Il Trovatore. From Il Trovatore, there's Squilli, Echeggi. William Berger, what's happening here?
We have men talking about what men talk about best, which is let's go to war and have fun and play with our toys. I think he's not glamorizing war in this case. It's also very funny, that wonderful tune in this chorus, which also, again, has another offbeat, you know, the emphasis on the offbeat, as in the Anvil chorus, showing this off-kilter world of Il Trovatore. But it also sounds just a touch like Humoresque and maybe even the Laurel and Hardy theme song, which is not to denigrate Verdi, it's just to show how deep this stuff runs once you've heard it.
So when we throw on the Verdi spotlight and we bathe our moment in time, right now, 2003, with it, what in your mind does it illuminate? I've already heard you say that it's challenging in the way that it embraces the individual. If it was challenging in the 19th century, it is just as challenging today. What else do you see illuminated here?
More so. More challenging now. Because as much as we revel in our freedoms and we talk about our individualism, all you need to do is look around. And you go to any city in America, you see the same stores, everybody's wearing the same thing. And I dare you to find any bit of color anywhere, right?
It's the Gap world. You're talking about the homogenized consumer world.
Absolutely. And boy, is it beige, right? I mean, I think that...
And often proudly, deliberately so.
Oddly. And I think some of our clothing chains have succeeded where Chairman Mao was only partially successful. So I think there's a graying down of the world that makes this message of Verdi. And it is, as a great Verdi scholar said at the end of his huge work, it is a message of hope that ultimately the individual does matter. And I think it's something we need to hear now more than ever.
When we pull away from that focus on the individual, though, we see in Verdi and in our time the great machinations of states and maybe even of war. You talked about the kind of mocking allusion to the male return again and again to war in the chorus we just heard. Well, it lives around us right now.
Absolutely. Verdi, sometimes in his life, did glorify war during the time of the Wars for Italian Unification, mm-hmm. and you can hear some very exciting martial choruses, but he did move to a place where people did not really perceive it as radical, but now I think we can, where even when issues of state are not questioned by the character, mm-hmm. but we still can see that his love, his focus is on the individual rather than on the needs of state. And they do tend to be unnecessarily stifling in other operas, literally so, where you see lovers buried alive mm-hmm. in suffocating worlds and this sort of thing. And his love is always, always for the individual. I think he confers a great deal of dignity on the individual by the way he wrote his music.
In that way, you say Verdi's work, Il Trovatore included, always has the capacity to get the hormones flowing. It's life-affirming. You call it Viagra for the spirit, even in the face of an off-kilter, wild, emotion-crazed world.
Absolutely, and especially in the face of that. I mean, not too long before Verdi wrote Il Trovatore, he had troops moving across his farm and, you know, was within earshot of battles. And the man knew a little bit about anarchy and the very present danger of war. So in the instances early on in his career when it seems like he's glorifying it, I would disagree. I would think he is acknowledging sometimes a necessity for it, but only when it is, and very clearly so, a move toward freedom. You know, and I think there's some truth to the more you're in touch with the fragility of the world, the less silly some of these extreme situations seem to you, say in the plots of Verdi operas, not only the plots, because, you know, plots don't matter.
They really don't.
The plots. But there are extremes of voices. You know, Leonora in Il Trovatore has to cover the entire range of what a human mm-hmm. voice can do. And there might be times when you're being complacent and blasé where you think, oh, why doesn't that woman just shut up? But then sometimes when you're more in touch with really the severity of life and of modern life, it doesn't seem all that out of the realm of possibility.
Not at all. Take the plot line, slice reality into any little bit, and what you'll find in there is probably wilder than any Verdi plot.
Right, and beyond the plot lines, just think of the music. Just think of the feelings that are represented by the music, the feelings of, and as so often in Verdi, even in Il Trovatore, oh my God, I just want to live.
Do we have to listen as kind of archaeologists, or do you think that this speaks straight to our central nervous system today?
The less archaeology, the better. Absolutely. I mean, I don't want to, you know, unemploy myself as a lecturer. So if people are interested in sort of, you know, what was going on at the time and what did Verdi mean when he used this structure and so on, I think that's all interesting. But again, Il Trovatore is not an intellectual exercise. It's at best, the cleanest way to put this is it's an emotional exercise. So you don't need to approach it as any kind of an ist. You need to be able to sit still for a couple of hours, either by your stereo or ideally in the theater.
And open your guts to something that's very primal.
Yes, without having to have any participation in it immediately of your own. You don't dance to it. You don't have to bop your head to keep the rhythm going. So it's a somewhat passive experience. Mm. That's hard for us to do. It's very hard for us to sit still.
And with that, we're out of time, but I want to thank you so much, William Berger, for joining us.
Thanks. I'm always happy to talk about Trovatore.
It's just been terrific. William Berger is a writer, lecturer, and author of many books on opera, including Verdi with a Vengeance and Wagner Without Fear. William Berger, Godspeed, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
He has been told to disarm for 11 long years. He's not disarming. This business about, you know, more time. You know, how much time do we need to see clearly that he's not disarming? As I said, this looks like a rerun of a bad movie, and I'm not interested in watching it.
Any decision on war belongs to the Security Council and the Security Council alone, once it has heard the report on the weapons inspectors. The second fact for us is that war is always an acceptance of failure, and it is always the worst of solutions.
Don't count on Germany voting for a resolution legitimizing war. Don't count on it.
You're right. Germany has been a problem, and France has been a problem. But you look at vast numbers of other countries in Europe. They're not with France and Germany on this. They're with the United States.
There is no candidate that is talking potential or real that can speak to the disaffected young people, minorities, women, gays and lesbians, with more credibility and more of a track record of advocacy than I have.
Respect for the right to life calls us to defend the sick and the dying, persons with disabilities and birth defects, and all who are weak and vulnerable. And this self-evident truth calls us to value and to protect the lives of innocent children waiting to be born.
The last thing we need is policies that divide us at home by race or riches. The ideals of America are not realized, but denied by a relentless ideology of tax giveaways for the few, and then even more tax giveaways for the few.
That in spite of all that has been achieved, we are only at the beginning. I'll say that again, in spite of everything we've done, we're only at the beginning of what will be a long struggle to protect this country from terrorism.
And there's a week President Bush expresses heated impatience with the weapons inspection process in Iraq. French President Jacques Chirac and German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder say do not count on their support for an attack on Iraq if it comes up for a vote in the United Nations. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld responds that the United States is essentially unconcerned about what France and Germany think. The Reverend Al Sharpton officially throws his hat in the 2004 presidential campaign ring. President Bush addresses anti-abortion protesters in a phone call on the
30th anniversary of the Roe v. Wade decision, Senator Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts rips into the president at a speech at the National Press Club and previews targets that Democratic presidential candidates may attack. And Tom Ridge is sworn in as the first Secretary of Homeland Security. It's all about Iraq this week, Jack, and the wheels turning and turning toward war.
Yes, I think so. To me, the important event of the week is the turnaround of Colin Powell. The last break on war within the administration is now gone. 2 weeks ago, he was saying the inspectors have to be given more time. He said yesterday or the day before, the inspections won't work. What changed was his confrontation with the French foreign minister at the UN. It hurt him personally. It embarrassed him within the administration. Above all, it apparently convinced him that no amount of resistance on the part of the Iraqis would be enough to get the French to and Germans to go along with a war resolution. And now he's even told his friends the United States should do this unilaterally, or rather with Britain.
Meaning that war may mean an open break with bedrock allies.
This is really I'm trying to think of parallels, and I'm sure others have better notions of it. But the one that comes to mind is Suez in 1956, mm-hmm. where the United States used its veto in the Security Council, I believe, and certainly used its pressure to order Britain and France, essentially, and Israel out of the Sinai and out of Egypt, where they were going to seize the Suez Canal. President Eisenhower just faced them all down. That was within the context of the Cold War, when you would have thought there would have been a bigger break on that sort of thing. So there's no now environing break, if you know what I mean, or there's
right.
no firewall to it.
And
there
was. Of course, the Suez incident was about keeping Western military power out of that region. This time it's about pushing American power at least in a very big way, with long-term consequences. And can you imagine what's it going to be like with France and Germany sitting on the "we told you so" or the outside on the other side of war? Strange.
It is strange. I mean, I've seen some people have speculated in the press that the French at least will come around because once they see that it's going to happen, just out of business motives. But who knows? Today at his press conference, Ari Fleischer was asked an ominous question. And the question was, have you seen the reports that Saddam is sending some of his chemical and biological weapons out of the country? And he said, I had seen those reports. I have no information on them. If there's anything to those reports, does this signal that Saddam is now convinced war is coming, and is this his effort to arm Iraqi agents? Is it his effort to send, as the CIA predicted would happen when he realized war was inevitable, is it his effort to give it to perhaps even to al-Qaeda? This is very, very frightening.
To keep an ace in the hole or give away an ace in the hole. And meanwhile, Donald Rumsfeld calling France and Germany part of old Europe and pointing to Eastern Europe as the new Europe and the new American sunrise. But can you imagine how that must rankle?
Oh, yeah. I mean, but you know, now the European, as an economic entity, Europe is bigger than the United States. And it's only a question of time, it seems to me, when the security interests of these two blocks are going to, there'll be commonality. But I think increasingly we're going to see distance just because the imperatives and our outlook on history is so different today.
Well, there are hawks in the Bush White House that want to open a new world with this war. Perhaps they may succeed on more fronts than we had imagined.
Ooh, boy, that's a thought, isn't it? We'll be allied with Moldavia and Slovakia and all those great powers to the east.
And the new Europe. Jack, yes. Thanks for being with us tonight.
All right, Tom, thank you.
And listeners, have a great weekend. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is W.